Quick check on WGTD Sports and Weather. The Michigan State team beat Louisville. Duke down Gonzaga yesterday to move on to the Final Four. Next Saturday, Michigan State takes on Duke. First game, 5:09 p.m. tip-off. Badgers in Kentucky, the second game, 7:49 tip-off. Both games are on TBS, that is Turner Broadcasting. NBA, the Bucks and Bulls, both off last night. Tonight, the Bucks are in Atlanta. The Bulls get another night off. National Hockey League, the Blackhawks beat Winnipeg 4-3. The Blackhawks host Los Angeles tonight. Now the WGTD Monday forecast from the National Weather Service. A sunny morning, a cloudy afternoon, a high of 57. Sunny right now, 38 degrees in Racine, 36 Kenosha, 33 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg up next. And support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911, offering the finest assortment of Easter candy from Fannie Mae, Russell Stover, and more. Treat your family to the best. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, Kenosha, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu.
As I am recording this interview, it is National Cerebral Palsy Awareness Day. And so I am so glad that I can spend a few minutes of this day with a man by the name of Bonner Paddock, who is an extraordinary inspiration to all kinds of people, but particularly for those who, like him, suffer from cerebral palsy. Bonner Paddock has not let cerebral palsy slow him down at all. As a matter of fact, he has gone on to accomplish much more athletically than most of the rest of us even dream of doing. And just some of what he has experienced in his life is told in a superb book called One More Step, My Story of Living with Cerebral Palsy, Climbing Kilimanjaro, and Surviving the Hardest Race on Earth. In this really inspiring book, Bonner Paddock talks about growing up with the harsh reality of cerebral palsy, but longing to just be like his schoolmates and like his brothers, and succeeding to some extent. But it was really only once he came to grips and fully embraced the fact that he had cerebral palsy, and particularly with the great inspiration of a young boy with cerebral palsy, in whose memory Bonner Paddock has stepped out on most of these adventures, that Bonner Paddock has built for himself an extraordinarily rich and inspiring life, which is told in this wonderful book. And by the way, his co-author is Neil Bascom, a very, very fine author with whom I had the pleasure of interviewing for his book called The Perfect Mile, which was the story of the quest for the first four-minute mile. He is the co-writer with Bonner Paddock, again, of this book published by HarperCollins called One More Step. Bonner Paddock, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much for having me.
For those of us who have people in our lives with cerebral palsy, we are probably especially astonished at what you have accomplished, because we think of cerebral palsy in certain specific terms, in terms of what a person with cerebral palsy can and cannot do. And you have certainly defied a lot of those expectations. Let's talk first of all about the way in which cerebral palsy affected you very concretely from a very, very early age. Tell us what some of the first indications were that something was amiss.
Yeah, absolutely. I have not very good leg coordination, so the best way I always explain how it affects me is if you haven't worked out, or if you've worked out really hard in six months and you go to the gym for the first time in a long time and you wake up the next morning and you're really stiff, that's kind of what I feel like every morning, is my body, my lower half of my body really does stiffen up, and there's considerable kind of pain just with the rigidity of my lower half. So from my lower back all the way through my feet is I don't have as much flexibility or movement as a quote-unquote typical person does. So it's, you kind of have a very stiff walk that, you know, knees kind of go inward, and it's very noticeable just from the naked eye, per se, of someone that's going to be like, wow, okay, you know, there's something a little bit off right there. So for me, it's primarily it affects the lower half of my body.
It was interesting, you kind of recount how long it took for doctors to come to really understand what was going on with you. I mean, you were the subject of one misdiagnosis after another. And I was especially surprised by the moment you describe when some doctor actually sort of blurted out words to the effect that you walk funny, or this young man walks funny. And it was actually, in a sense, liberating to hear a doctor actually fully acknowledge something that you and your family knew to be true, but which other doctors ahead of that had simply not wanted to or felt inclined to address. Tell our listeners about that moment.
Yeah, it's a very interesting moment, because our family wasn't a very communicative family. We didn't talk a lot. We're very siloed. Parents got separated at a very young age. So there was a lot of that time where, if it wasn't per se normal, it wasn't really discussed. It was just kind of been like, okay. And so the only time I ever saw a lot of these doctors was, you know, when I'd go into the hospital or anything, if I broke a bone or, you know, anything else like that, the basic stuff. So we didn't really like rush around everywhere, because I was able to walk and everything else. So it was one of those moments where, you know, just when the doctors would take notice of it, if I walked, you know, for a good distance, they basically would make a comment that seemed like somewhere here and there. And I was really young, so it was really unfamiliar, mainly with me, but mostly obviously with my mom, that she was the one that was at all these. So it was this odd thing where we really didn't talk about it that much. We just knew that there was something different, and we never really could put a thumb on it for a long time until I was 11 years old, and that's when we got, you know, officially properly diagnosed and was able to get at least a beginning pathway of going to physical therapy and everything after school. Those are the things that then it became to be a little bit more prominent in my life, where it wasn't really talked that much, except it was noticed and commented by people that, you know, did you hurt your knee? Did you hurt your hip? You know, those are the type of things, because they weren't quite sure, you know, what I had.
So for the most part, did your peers, I'm thinking like when you're in junior high and high school and you are playing soccer and playing basketball and so on, but doing so with this situation that was, of course, a serious complication, did they tend to know? Did you tend to share this with anybody, or did you just muscle through as best you could, and were you content to just have people think of you as just a bit awkward?
Yeah, we went with more of the bit awkward route, and it was something that we didn't, you know, I didn't want really anybody to know, and it was something that I was worried what people would say if I told people I had it. So it was something that grew into a really big secret of mine for almost 30 years of my life. So it was something that I could go out and do some sports and, you know, wasn't always the best player on each team and everything, but was really determined and stubborn. So that helped me kind of get farther than most of the kids, just with willing to outwork, you know, them for the effort for in sports and everything. But everybody always knew, it seemed like, now talking to them, looking back, they always said, yeah, you know, there was always something we weren't sure, but nobody ever spoke about it. Nobody really asked. So it was really kind of unknown, even to my brother, even into his 20s, which was surprising when we wrote the book and Neil got that from him in his interview. So even my brother didn't know I officially had cerebral palsy until he was in his 20s. It just shows you how siloed our family was and really poor communication we had amongst each other.
Right. Sometimes we will read the story of somebody who is contending with cerebral palsy or something else, and they really strive to live as normal a life as they possibly can. I mean, making no excuses for themselves, not setting limits because of that. And we find that really inspirational. I think what you're saying here is, in a sense, you and your family almost took that too far by not acknowledging the fact that you had cerebral palsy. And I'm guessing that your advice to, for instance, a young person in roughly the same situation would be to not quite muscle through to the same extent that they actually bury the reality that they have cerebral palsy.
Yeah, I think you said it exactly perfectly, is that it's one of those things that I think, you know, when you don't know what you have, but yes, you're muscling through it, you know, there's maybe some, you know, people can say, well, that's really admirable, but, you know, I think it's that balance, and everybody can be an armchair quarterback, you know, Monday morning quarterback, you know, to say maybe we didn't, but the real true thing is talk about it, embrace it, but also then also make no excuses for it either. And there's that balance that I think is the ideal for any parent or anybody raising kids, no matter what they have, is that you got to keep pushing them and you got to let them be themselves, but you got to be able to talk about what it is. And if they do have, you know, their challenges, you got to address them, because we're all human. So at some juncture, we do come across our own limitations or challenges, and being positive and addressing and talking about them is the best way for them to be comfortable, that they know they have it, but you don't have to use it as a crutch.
We are speaking with Bonner Paddock, who writes about the reality of living with cerebral palsy in a memoir called One More Step, My Story of Living with Cerebral Palsy, Climbing Kilimanjaro and Surviving the Hardest Race on Earth. Certainly for you, a gigantic breakthrough in thinking differently about yourself and the fact that you had cerebral palsy has to do with meeting an extraordinary young boy by the name of Jake. Tell our listeners about Jake and how your encounter with him and his family made such an enormous difference in your life.
Absolutely. Jakey was a 4.5-year-old boy that had a very severe case of CP, couldn't walk or talk, and I had met his dad with the local charity here in Orange County, UCP of Orange County, that he was on the board of, and I had reached out to volunteer at. And through that meeting, he actually went home and told his wife about me, and he sent me an email and said, "You give us hope for our son, Jakey." And that was like the first person that had responded back to me when I began to start telling people that I had CP at about 29 years old. And that was a huge light bulb above my head, that people were accepting me and loving me for who I was. That if I could give hope to a family just by sharing my story was just mind-boggling to me, when I was just trying to be normal and just try to be like everybody else and, you know, hold down a job. And so for them, there was that instant connection. And I had only been and met Jakey in person like for 10 minutes of his life before he suddenly passed away. So it's just a bizarre kind of experience, in terms of his family was the first ones to accept and love me. And then we just had this bond that we had shared, you know, in a short amount of 6-month period, but of acceptance and love. And for me, that was a lot of things that I definitely wanted and needed, and they were one of the first outlets for that. So it just was this instant bond.
My recollection is that phone call with the news that young Jake had died came at an incredibly dramatic moment. Tell us about the timing of that.
Yeah, it was the morning after JG's dad and I had run the half marathon for the charity. They were the charity partner of the Orange County Marathon, and so he was running the full marathon for Jakey, who was was alive that day, and I was doing the half. But I stuck to him, and we ran the first part of the course together, and we talked a lot about, you know, what it's like for me. And I guess I, at that juncture, I didn't know, but he was really having a hard time connecting with his son, and so he was talking and asking me questions to try to understand and learn maybe if this is what Jakey was maybe thinking about inside his mind, since he couldn't talk. So it was a really special, you know, few hours out there on the course talking with him while we're out there running and suffering and everything else. But it was just an unbelievable bonding experience, and so much so that I didn't train that much on it. So I called in sick to work the next day because I was so stiff. And I got the news from the executive director at UCP that, you know, Jakey had died that night, and it was just like mind-blowing and, you know, very emotional. And I just told him right then and there that I was going to run the full marathon that next year in Jakey's honor. So it was a very, very powerful moment for me.
I don't think we've actually touched on what actually gave you the impetus to embrace the reality of having cerebral palsy and of speaking about it openly and even publicly. I mean, a dramatic step really for anybody, but particularly for someone like you who had, in a sense, buried this reality for such a long time. What were the events that sort of came together that that put you into such a different place regarding your own CP?
It was getting to a point in my adult life where, you know, you really are noticing that I had a huge secret, and it's not a great feeling at all. It becomes like a lot of pressure or weight on your shoulders, and it wasn't a healthy feeling at all to say, some juncture I got to figure out. But when you get so dark down in this like hole or whatever, you're trying to figure out, I don't even know how to get out. So luckily I had a great boss named Ron Seaver, and about a year after working for him, I walked into his office and told him that I had something to say and that I had cerebral palsy, and he was like, okay, Bond man, that's great. Like, do you need any help with anything? Do you need a parking spot closer? And I was like, nope, I just want to let you know. And I just like ducked out of his office like right away. So it took a person that I really trusted in terms of the business world, and he's a great friend, and I knew that he would accept me, I guess. And so that was that started giving me the confidence that every job I got to talk to before they hire me. And then it just is the beginning of a snowball effect, pretty much.
Hmm. So explain to our listeners how the running of first a half marathon and then a full marathon and then the amazing adventures which followed thereafter. But let's stick with just the running marathons part. A huge undertaking for anybody. I mean, an undertaking that would probably kill a lot of us, me included, were we to undertake it without proper training, certainly. And even then, it just boggles the imagination for those of us who are, in a sense, fully able-bodied. For you specifically, what were the most specific issues that your cerebral palsy caused? I mean, what were the ways in which this was even more difficult for you?
For me, the pain is very difficult, and it is a lot in my legs. And so what it is I have spastic diplegia, which means that, you know, my muscles spasm when the heart rate gets, you know, really high, or the blood, you know, increases in the leg area is the best way to kind of simply explain it. But my muscles don't relax fully, and then they're a lot tighter than most. So to use my legs to go out and do a half marathon or a full marathon when they're very stiff and rigid does a lot of damage to those legs, because they're not moving like the nice shock absorbers that they're supposed to and have flexibility and, you know, strong movement. So, you know, my legs aren't as strong as most people's. They're stiffer, so the muscles tear and they cramp up faster, because when they're tight, there's not as much moisture in them. So you have this kind of quick cycle of doing long-term things like a half marathon and full marathon are, you know, extremely difficult for, you know, someone with tight legs and those types of things. So it's a very stiff and rigid run on your body. For us, it just kind of hammers the body a lot more, especially the bottoms of your feet and your ankles.
As we read your book and the accounts of this, it's just incredible to think about somebody sustaining that amount of pain and, in a sense, also doing so much damage to their own body. I mean, one of the things you describe very vividly in this book is not just the pain of the actual running, but then the pain of the aftermath. Is there any significant risk that you have been, in a sense, punishing your own body too much? And in what has helped you try to make determinations about exactly how much punishment to, in a sense, inflict upon yourself?
Yeah, it definitely inflicts a lot of punishment, so much so that the doctors, you know, aren't happy when I go out and attempt these, you know, feats or stunts or whatever adventures. But it's one of those things that through my being, you know, talking about CP and then meeting so many families of kids both here and in Africa, you start meeting and understanding like the amazing gifts that I've got are these legs. As much as they may hurt each morning and they may be stiffer and, you know, maybe more pain when you run, like I've got the amazing gift to use them every day. And so if I didn't do all these things, in my opinion, I wouldn't be utilizing to the max, you know, these gifts that I've been given, and hopefully, you know, raise a ton of money and awareness for, you know, these awesome families that are out there trying to get motivated and need help out there. So it's kind of one of those hard things that you could say, okay, I need to stay and rest them because it's probably going to cause long-term damage to them. But if I didn't have these legs, I wouldn't even have that opportunity. So I feel like I've got an opportunity to go out there and really hopefully raise and push that they can inspire some other people to, you know, get out there and understand just amazing basic things that we take for granted, like legs or eyes or something like that, that a lot of these kids don't have.
Hmm. We're speaking with Bonner Paddock about his memoir, One More Step, My Story of Living with Cerebral Palsy, Climbing Kilimanjaro and Surviving the Hardest Race on Earth. So we've already talked about the fact that you were willing to undertake the grueling pain of running first a partial marathon and then a full marathon. And from there, you decide to climb not just some mountain, but one of the tallest mountains on Earth, Mount Kilimanjaro. This had to represent a step up of audacity, let's say, in terms of the kind of challenge that you were taking on. Explain how this represented a still more potentially dangerous undertaking for you, and what fueled your determination to do it nevertheless.
Absolutely. The stiffness in my legs obviously creates a lot of balance issues, and that's just kind of the coordination isn't that great. So put yourself on a mountain, and you know that the summit's going to be at night, and you're going to have to go through. It was basically some of my biggest fears, and instead of probably thinking it through a little bit more wisely, you know, I threw myself into it saying, the only way you're going to get, you know, address your fears is go after the biggest ones in the biggest moments. And so that's why I chose Kilimanjaro, because of its 8 days, it's, you know, almost three times as much long as like 64 miles to get to the summit and back. So it was a lot longer than the marathon. It was more days. So all of it was continuing to push both physically and then mentally, was seeing if I could address a lot of my biggest fears of what I've avoided for so many years with my legs and my balance and everything like that. So I would say that it was pretty naively that I went over there and did it with not enough research and talking to people, but it was something that I knew was way grander in scale. And it worked in terms of raising a ton of money for UCP of Orange County, so we raised over $250,000 for that attempt. So it worked in that end, but other ends, it still left me kind of in dealing with the wrong way, how to get out and get more comfortable with being yourself.
Hmm. One of the things that's, of course, a very harsh reality of any kind of mountain climbing, but particularly when it comes to that sort of thing, is that we're dealing with all kinds of physical debilitation. Apart from the actual damage done to feet and legs and so on in the actual climb, but the fact of being at such a high altitude and having bodily functions altered and in other ways, too, it's just a difficult place to live, even if you're not climbing. I mean, just to sit still in these extremely high altitudes. Was any of that exacerbated by the fact that you had cerebral palsy, or was that not a particularly significant contributing factor?
So I think what worried myself and the doctors the most was, as the altitude goes up, you know, my understanding and reading and everything and talking with them is, you know, your brain kind of swells when there's lack of oxygen, and your body's looking for as much, you know, oxygen as possible. That's where you get the really bad headaches and everything else. And obviously some people, you know, have the edemas and everything that, you know, ends their life. And those are the things that concern them most, because cerebral palsy, you know, is, you know, when random parts of your brain die. For me, when the umbilical cord was wrapped around my neck during the birth process. So, you know, we're going up there with a neurological disability, you know, per se, that controls the muscles in my legs. And what will that do, you know, if the brain starts to overload or swell, you know, does that shut down my legs? What does that do for somebody that has CP versus, you know, someone that his brain is per se normal functioning? So there were a lot of those things that, what would the altitude do at that height, and the length of time that we were up on that mountain for sure was our biggest concerns.
Hmm. Well, you survived, and not only survived, but actually shook off the pain and trauma of that, and decided to undertake something which was equally daring and audacious, namely to compete as an Ironman triathlete. Looking back, was this even a harder undertaking?
Yeah, it was both physically and mentally. It was because it's all in one day. It's compacted, and it's now even the distance is greater than all of Kilimanjaro. It was almost double the distance lengthwise than Kilimanjaro was. It's all, in 17 hours. So the length of brutality in one day where, being so tight muscles, we're not really supposed to be or able to do endurance events. You slam it all into one day, and you have to deliver that day. You can't come back the next day. That race is one day with 17-hour limit. So it compacted everything of a pretty massive smashing to the body and everything else in one day.
It was interesting. I think it was during the triathlon, but it might have been also in the mountain climb. But one of the things that would fuel your determination was not just thinking about young Jake, and the way in which he was such an inspiration to you, but you also called upon, in a sense, darker forces, forces like anger, when you thought about moments in your past when, for instance, you had been made fun of or told that you couldn't possibly do something. Just say a word about that, and if you think that was what just had to be at that moment in time, or is that a good way to make this kind of amazing accomplishment happen?
It happened on Kilimanjaro, and it was when I was just so beyond exhaustion that I couldn't kind of force it away in my brain. And so a lot of that anger and stuff started coming out on the mountain at myself, and just kind of talking into the air. So that happened on Kilimanjaro. That was a part that I didn't like. And then luckily, working with Welchy through Ironman, he taught me how to appreciate the journey and begin to, love and respect myself. So Ironman, it was all positive reinforcement and doing it for all these, a lot of positive things that had happened in my life. So even though the two world records, people look at them, they were drastically different. One was fear-based and the other was love-based, with understanding where my life is going, being confident who I am, comfortable with my disability, all of that. That was the Ironman journey. The Kilimanjaro journey was all fear-based, hadn't dealt with anything, threw myself at it, thought it would be a good idea, looking for that instant happy pill, and it just isn't there. So I had, between those two journeys, I had to really work on myself and deal with a lot of, those issues that I had and let them all go. And that's why Ironman was possible through positive. I don't think I could have done Ironman, with the anger and everything else. It was, had to dig deep for people that, help and everything.
It's really an incredible story, and you appear to look back on this gauntlet with very, very little regret. I mean, for all the pain which you have experienced, and the fact that probably a couple of times over, you could have perhaps even died, but this evidently has been well worth the effort and the sacrifices that it has represented.
Absolutely. It's worth all the pain and everything else, and hopefully with the book and the feedback that I've gotten so far from a lot of people, is they say it's just been very empowering for them to read something, and someone that expressed all their pros and cons of their life, is they say it's very nice to read that. So I said, that's fantastic, and it was totally worth all of it.
What was it like to actually sit down and write this story and to kind of make sense of it, and in particular to kind of dig into some of the more painful aspects of your childhood and the dynamics in your family and so on? Was that difficult?
It was extremely difficult, and it got into the mental pain that I still had, and Neil did a great job of asking those hard questions about my past, and so I was able to, through many times it took to get it, but I had to go back and start to try to understand and relive those moments, explain them to Neil, and then hopefully deal with them now properly, because I'm, in a better place in my life. So I was able to kind of deal with those things and then let them go, forgive everybody, and just let it move on and keep staying focused going forward. So for the 2+ years we did the book, it actually was kind of, my therapist was that book, and, explaining and going through all those things, it really was empowering to just let it all out and let it go and just be like, it was, it happened, and let's all just move forward. So the mental, you know, it was actually harder than Ironman, in my opinion, because it was mental wounds that I was dealing with, which turned out to be a lot harder to deal with than my physical wounds from Ironman and Kilimanjaro.
Let's finish by talking about the foundation which you created, the OM Foundation, OM standing for One Man, One Mission. Explain the mission of the OM Foundation.
Yeah, we started that after we got back from Tanzania and climbing Kilimanjaro, just seeing that it's a global need to really address, you know, kids with disabilities. And I said, There's no way I'm going to be able to do it, you know, volunteering there and then finding another charity to volunteer in Africa. And I said, I want to form my own foundation that can support, you know, the disabled community here in the United States, but also help the amazing people that we had met in Tanzania when we were climbing Kilimanjaro. So what we try to do is raise money that, and then give to great programs that either already exist or start one with a partner charity that's already established in these regions. And it's to provide early learning therapy services, so physical therapy, speech therapy, and occupational therapy. And so whether it's with a school in Tanzania called Faraja that we're, you know, proud partners of, or, you know, here with UCP of Orange County with their, you know, Life Without Limits Center, we try to basically raise the money and then donate it into the community to either build the centers or support existing centers with those services.
Well, we applaud you on not only all that you have accomplished, but we applaud you for the good work of the OM Foundation. And we encourage people to take in hand your very inspiring memoir, again, called One More Step, My Story of Living with Cerebral Palsy, Climbing Kilimanjaro, and Surviving the Hardest Race on Earth, published by HarperCollins. Bonapadhyay, thank you for joining me today. This has been
a
pleasure.
Thank you very much for having me.
And indeed, I am honored now for the next few minutes to be speaking with Jonathan Kozal, who is the author of a number of different books, including now a book called Letters to a Young Teacher, published by Crown, in which we can read some of the letters which he wrote to a young teacher who contacted him, someone he calls in the pages of this book Francesca. That is not her name, and she remains an anonymous figure, but the catalyst for some very, very helpful letters that that Jonathan Kozal has written for the young teacher just starting out in this paramountly important vocation. Jonathan Kozal, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks very much, and I'm glad you said what you did about my new book. The whole point of Letters to a Young Teacher is to present a kind of tribute, but also an invitation to what I believe to be admittedly very difficult, but still beautiful profession. I think teaching children in our public schools, and especially teaching young children, is one of the best ways a human being could spend their life. And I began as a teacher myself, teaching little kids in inner-city schools, all black schools, and now this young teacher, this wonderful young teacher, wrote to me, and she was teaching also at an all-black school in Boston, my hometown, in a neighborhood not far from where I'd started out 40 years before. So she said, would you come and visit my class? Lots of teachers asked me to do that, and I did. And, of course, as soon as I arrived, she put me to work, because teachers... I love it the way teachers knock me off my pedestal. You know, I don't like to be treated as an author or some kind of expert. They say, don't just stand there. Do something.
Yeah, grab those paints or whatever.
Help my kids. My kids.
In fact,
Then when I did it wrong, actually, first thing she asked me to do, I messed it up. She scolded me in front of the children. I love that. She's, 24 years old, and she said, Mr. Jonathan, since the kids couldn't pronounce Kozal, my last name, she said, Mr. Jonathan did not pay attention. He is not behaving like a grown-up. What should we do to punish him? And the kids voted. have little kids, and she's one of these glowing souls that, you know, the kind of teacher little kids will remember their whole lives. Just flooded her room with poetry and wonderful poetry. Not, you know, lots of African American poetry, but also she was immersed in great literature herself. So she was reading these little first graders poetry by William Butler Yeats, and but you'd come in the room and it'd be flooded with music like Brahms and Rachmaninoff, and she absolutely refused to drill her children for examinations, for tests. She hated this law, No Child Left Behind. She refused to impose that kind of drill and kill routine to get the kids ready for their tests, and despite that, almost all her kids did very well in their exams, which is a tribute, I think, to her enormous creativity, because she worked hard. She just would not, she refused to impose a kind of proto-military regime on these kids, which is very, very common now in inner-city schools.
She was, of course, coming to you for advice, although it sounds like she was a very gifted teacher with a lot of wonderful instincts. And one of your most central points of advice for her and other young teachers is the idea of establishing chemistry between yourself and the student, as opposed to the often advised protocol of starting out tough, sticking to the curriculum, that sort of thing. You suggest instead entrapping them first in fascination. I love the way you put that.
Absolutely. I think especially with young kids in anywhere from kindergarten to fourth grade, it's very, very important to convince them right from the start that learning is exciting, that it's a joyful, mysterious, exhilarating experience. And she conveyed that to them. She had this sense of jubilation in her. She was enormously happy to be in the company of children, and people who aren't shouldn't teach school, I don't think. Fortunately, there are thousands like her nowadays, but she, there's a special, I talk about the chemistry that evolves, the kind of mystical chemistry of trust and love that evolves between a good teacher and her students, and it's a very beautiful thing to see, especially in those early grades when they come to you in September, they're little strangers. In June, you cry because you don't want to say goodbye to them. And I tell teachers that that chemistry is more important than anything else. Mm. Don't let any of these tough testing demands that are coming down from Washington interfere with that. Don't let anything ruin that chemistry. If you lose that, you lose everything.
As you describe this in various chapters, the unfolding of this relationship, this chemistry, I think one of the most telling moments is when you talk of the importance of those small little moments when a young child might reveal to a teacher some sort of secret. You say some children who reveal their secrets to us in these hesitant and bashful ways seem to feel empowered later to reveal themselves in more outgoing ways as they begin to gain the literary skills to write in classroom journals, for instance, or maybe make their first attempts at poetry. I mean, I think that's such an important bit of advice, because that's the sort of thing, the importance of which might not maybe be immediately apparent to a young teacher.
That's right. And one reason is that young teachers nowadays, again, I don't like to harp on this repeatedly, but the law No Child Left Behind has had a very damaging effect in this respect. The law requires that teachers stick to a very tight timetable. And I might say, the whole idea of the law is that teachers need to be held accountable for their success. And I don't know any teacher who's afraid to be held accountable, but they want to be held accountable for the right things. And what happens in many of these inner-city schools, in Milwaukee, for example, in Chicago, in New York, is that because the demands that the state requires, the state standards, as they're called, which are enforced at the national level by the federal law, No Child Left Behind, there's very tight timing in the classroom. You've got to deliver this specific skill at 9:35 in the morning. And what happens is that, you know, little kids are determined to subvert our lesson plans because they want to tell us something interesting that happened to them that comes right out of their heart. So little boy raises his hand and says, "Teacher, you know, my grandma died yesterday, and he wants to tell her about this." And she feels, I mean, Francesca would listen, but many teachers feel, "I can't listen to this because if some supervisor comes around and checks on my classroom, I won't be on the required skill for that moment, that minute of the day." And so she has to cut him off. If she listens, you'll often find that at the end of those delectable run-on sentences at which little children are so good, there's a real piece of hidden treasure where that child reveals something about himself. Let's say it's a little boy, something deep and important to his soul. And good teachers seize upon that moment as a key to unlock motivation in the child. But in too many of these inner-city schools now, the teacher's afraid to do that. She has to cut him off. And so she never finds that secret in his soul. I was strongly influenced, this may surprise many of your listeners, I was strongly influenced by a man I believe to be probably the best educator of young children of the past 50 years in the United States. And this was not some academic person. This was Mr. Rogers, Fred Rogers, who came with me up to the South Bronx, where several of my books take place in New York City, to meet the children I was writing about. And he always said to me, "Listen to these children. Listen to them. Don't rush them. Give them a chance so they can reveal themselves to you."
I like how you say about Mr. Rogers, you say Mr. Rogers' legacy is viewed as soft and too impressionistic in an age when very hard and measurable outcomes have been stringently demanded by the overseers of public education, whose certitude about the practices that they enforce seems nearly absolute. You are really fervently hoping that, at least to some extent, we can return more to the view that people like Fred Rogers have about what is most important in education.
Absolutely, and I'm my whole book, Letters to Young Children, is dedicated to that ideal, but I'm also fighting politically. I've spent a great deal of the past summer in Washington talking with the members of the Senate and the House who are going to decide in the next few months whether to repeal this federal law or to continue it or to revise it dramatically. And as a matter of fact, a few weeks from now, I'm going to meet with probably the most influential member of the Senate who chairs the Education Committee, and that's Senator Ted Kennedy. We have a date set in which I want to convince him that Senate and House absolutely need to reduce the testing mania. They ought to reduce it drastically, and instead of putting all the pressure on a one-time examination in order to measure whether a child is learning or whether a school or a teacher is any good, they ought to look at more important things, such as how many children are in that classroom? Are we giving these poor kids the same wonderful small class size of 17 or 18 children that you'd see in the rich suburbs? Are we packing 30, 35 kids into each room? Hmm. How many of these kids are getting preschool? Because we know the affluent typically give their children 2 or 3 years of wonderful preschool, whereas the inner city kids get almost nothing. Unless you give universal preschool to these poor kids, then when you test them on exams a few years later, you're testing rich kids on twice as much education as the poor children have received. So I'm also actually demanding that Senator Kennedy write into this law, No Child Left Behind, a provision that that states have to guarantee at least 2 years of rich developmental preschool to all low-income children before they can give them the standardized exam.
Hmm. I want to mention that your book focuses on a number of specific issues, which unfortunately we have no time to talk about today, but things like focus on diversity and the state of high schools and middle schools and so on, all kinds of interesting information. I actually want to close with something else, though, something in which you celebrate the attitude and perspective of this young teacher with whom you corresponded. You say, one of the reasons why I have found our conversations and our correspondence so refreshing, this is again speaking to Francesca, is that you enjoy so much the small realities and daily misadventures, even the wet and messy ones, that take place in the classroom with your children. And those are probably very, very important words of reassurance and encouragement that teachers not sweep those kind of moments aside, but embrace them as being central sometimes to the whole experience of teachers and children.
Yeah, she once said to me, when one of her children peed or something like that in his pants, because he's a little baby, she said, six-year-olds are leaky little people. And the way she said that showed that she loved them completely. And I say to teachers, you're in a tough time right now. It's a tough era where people are threatening your profession. There's enormous political contempt for teachers. I hear it in Washington all the time. And there's a strong movement, the voucher movement, to try to basically dismantle public education and throw away this great legacy that we've been given as Americans. But I say to teachers, despite all of that, hold up the sense of delight and joy in being a teacher. And no matter what's going on the political front, bring your own beautiful personality into that classroom. Flood that classroom with all the treasures of poetry and everything that you've loved in your own life. And don't let anybody take that away from you. That's because if teachers aren't happy in the classroom, they're not going to be good teachers, and they're going to quit. We want to keep them. We've got to enable them to enjoy that same sense of jubilation that I described throughout this book.
The book, again, is called Letters to a Young Teacher, published by Crown. Jonathan Kozal, I appreciate you joining me today on The Morning Show, and very best wishes to you.
Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
And tomorrow on The Morning Show, Harriet Brown and a fascinating new book called Body of Truth, which explores our culture's obsession with weight. Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. Support also comes from Andrea's, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911, offering the finest assortment of Easter candy from Fannie Mae, Russell Stover, and more. Treat your family to the best. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street. Online at andreasgifts.com. Sunshine this morning, a few more clouds by the afternoon, a high of 57 degrees, with a 30% chance of rain by tonight, a low of 38 degrees. Tomorrow should be another sunny day, a high tomorrow close to 50 degrees. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha Racine.